Okay, so while we're waiting for Venerable George to arrive, I'd like to go ahead and read the prayer list. Prayers for happy rebirth. All those killed by natural and man-made disasters, all the Tibetans have been killed or have taken their own lives in the struggle for religious freedom. Geshe Sopa Rinpoche, Venerable Losan Cherki, Dr. Diane Carlson, Andy Chauvin, Ray Allen DeMarcy, James Foley, Wendy Johnson, Stephen Sotloff, Robin Williams, Gersimi the Cat, and Scooter the Dog. Job Search, Roseanne Barona, Joey Gooch, Joe Griffiths, Jim Kay, Michelle Matich, Alex Schwartz, Greg Weaver, Sandy Wimbush. Prayers for Health and Well-Being, Kyabje Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Venerable Margaret McAndrew, Venerable Cherki Lamo, Venerable Losang Tseren, Geshe Sangpo, his mother, all those harmed by natural and man-made disasters. For the Tibetan people and for the Chinese authorities, may the nonviolent path lead to full reconciliation and religious freedom. Bill Alford, Russell Allen, Lisa Baranski, Jim Barnes, Luce Barona, Narcisse Barona Sr., Roseanne Barona, Bob and Rochelle, Willa Cherrett, Diana Dietzler, Chusano and her children, Anna Clark, Dimitri Diamandopoulos, Suzanne Diamandopoulos, Diane Foreman and son Brad Wolf, Gigi and AC, Robert Gruber, Jimmy Gooch and family, Mildred Gooch, Tracy Haas Thompson, Kathy Hayashi, Francis Hayashi, Leslie and Joan Inman, Nick Jablins, family of Wendy Johnson, Kenny Jackson, Buddy, Helen Kasanoff, Jessica Kasanoff, and the Pristop family, Nina Kowalski, Shanti and Kurt Latimer, Mary Lojek, Danny Love, R.M., Jim Martin and Andrew Martin, Tom McGinnity, Scotty McLean, Catherine Mayer, Sarah Miller, Colleen Mitchell, Shia Molly Mitra, Evan Myrtle and family, William Oliver, Jay Pondia, Cindy Parrish, Anna Papard and her many cousins throughout the Ukraine, Ken Roman, Eileen Rubin and family, Ariana Scott, Rosemary Cease, Sarai, Diesel Shoot, Nancy Sorbit, Freddie Todd, Lobsang Tupten, Brady Ware, Dion Washington, Jessica Whitmore, Olivia Wilson, Shay Wokowiki, Dorje and Kato the Pig, Grady the Dog. So if you've never been to the center before, when Venerable George arrives, if you please stand out of respect for him and his teachings, then I believe he lets us prostrate with him. Usually teachers, the tradition is to prostrate after he prostrates, but he has been doing that, letting us prostrate along with him at the same time. And then after he's seated, we'll say some prayers in the white prayer book. And if you're sitting in a pew, it's at the end of the pew toward this aisle, the door aisle. And you may have to share a copy. And we'll go to the first bay sheet. And I'm assuming he's going to let me... this is the first Sunday that Venerable George will be teaching, recently. So I'm assuming we're going to do the same thing that we usually do, which is chant Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra three times, then four immeasurables in English, and then in Tibetan. And then if we turn the page, chant the two mantras at the bottom of the pink sheet. If you have cell phones, if you please put them on vibrate. Let's see. Check my, yep. And, or turn them off. When Geshe-la was here, our resident teacher, he encouraged us to walk around, circumambulate the stupa clockwise. It has tremendous, for accumulation of tremendous merit, purification practice. It has Dharmakaya relics in it, which are the primary relics. Relics such as, like the robes of Shakyamuni Buddha or his, pearl-like bones. Those are secondary relics. So it has millions of those Dharmakaya relics in them. So it's very powerful. practice, and also to turn the prayer wheels on the outside on the way to and from the stupas. Also, it has, there are many thousands of Chenrezig mantras in them, and so it's also a very good practice. You're welcome to bring drinks in here if you like. Let's see. I think that's all. Can you remember, think of anything else? I can't think of anything else. Okay. And usually during the second session, Geshe-la has been teaching the same topics, you know, and I'm assuming Venerable George will do the same thing. I'm not quite sure. So we'll see. Yes, for the first session, yes. Yes, sir. Yeah, I guess. There's a little switch at the top. There's two, okay.
Two. Oh, okay, there we go. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so if you turn to the first base sheet in the White Prayer Book, let's chant Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra three times, then the Four Immeasurables in English, and then right below that with the music notes in Tibetan. Taya ta mune mune ma munaye swaha. Taya ta mune mune ma munaye May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Sentientam Chedewa Dom Dewe Yudam Dempar Juchi Dunya Dandu Nyagi Nidang Then if you'll please turn the page to the first pink sheet. In the bottom, you see two mantras. So let's chant Chen Reizik's mantra 8 times, and then Green Tower's mantra right above that 7 times. Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha.
Thank you. Good morning. How's everyone? Good to see you. So, I listened to the last talk that Geshe-la gave before he left. It's on the up on the website. You can. Did you know that you can listen to things if you miss them, or if you want to share with other people? And so I thought I would just sort of continue in a little bit of the vein. He was talking about compassion, and he had mentioned sometime during that talk about the meditation called Tonglen. Have you done Tonglen before? I don't know what Tonglen is. Okay. So giving and taking. So I just wanted to mention a couple of things. Just out of curiosity, are there some people here who are have come to Kadampa for the first time or nearly first time that haven't been here many times? Oh, okay, good. Okay, so we're going to begin also with a little bit of meditation, if it's okay with you. Generally, when people think about Buddhism, they often think meditation is kind of one of the defining characteristics of Buddhist practice, right? And it is. There are different kinds of meditation. And one of the things that we can find a lot of benefit from is in our everyday life is spending a little time in the morning and in the evening, say before you go to bed, meditating to calm the mind from the stream of the consciousness that's jumping around like a monkey from branch to branch in a tree. In fact, that's a symbol that's often used for the uncontrolled mind, our monkey mind. What we do is focus our mind on an object, and I don't necessarily mean like a physical object like a candle or something in front of you. When you do concentration, you don't do it with your eyes. You do it with your mental consciousness. Sometimes I think sometimes we may not even differentiate in our common life growing up what mental consciousness is. Mental consciousness is different than our eye, ear, nose, taste, and touch, tactile consciousness. Mental consciousness is that within which you think, you plan, you remember. There are daydreams that take place. Mental consciousness is that which gets angry, which forgives, which loves, which is patient, which is jealous. Those kinds of activities are not done with the eye or ear. Even though you might think your eye is drawn to something attractive, you might think that your eye has. We talk about looking at someone with a loving eye, don't we? But that it, the eye is not doing the loving. The eye or the expression of the face may be an expression of your mental consciousness. So our meditation is done with a mental consciousness. And it's done profitably with when the spine is straight. So all of you are sitting, you know, in a nice comfortable position. Some people are on the floor, which can make which can facilitate a longer-term meditation if you sit cross-legged. Anyway, sitting comfortably and just relaxing your body and reminding yourself that you don't have to think about anything else right now other than what's going on. You don't have to worry about home or what you're going to have for lunch or who won the football game yesterday. You can just focus on this sort of meditative exercise. Just place your attention very gently with your eyes just slightly open. Place your attention on watching your breathing, being aware of your breathing. So now watching here doesn't mean watching with your eyes. Notice when you're breathing in. You can even say to yourself, I'm breathing in mentally. And then just try to notice the point where it changes direction to breathing out. And likewise, after the exhalation, breathing out, try to recognize the point where it changes, just sort of stops and begins to come in. Just do that for a few respirations. Don't think of it simply as a mechanical thing, you're just chugging out breaths mechanically, but let your breathing become natural. Don't control it. And just watch it from the side of your mind. And if you notice other thoughts coming, don't try to force them away, but cause them to disappear by focusing more of your attention on the breathing. don't pay attention to what your eyes are seeing or other sounds, traffic going by. There'll probably be a train at some point. There might be, I don't know, today, maybe there's not on Sundays. Don't pay attention to your ear consciousness. Then add another chore to your mind. Mentally count the respirations. You can think, for instance, like this. Now I'm breathing. The first inhalation is coming in, still coming in. Now it's just stopping. And the first exhalation is going out. I'm exhaling. Now it's just changing directions. Now the second inhalation is coming in. Look, you can think like that, or you can mentally imagine numbers. You know, you count a whole inhalation and exhalation as one number. You can imagine numbers are like the calendars that you flip over. You can imagine that. But see if you can add that to the chore that your mental consciousness is doing, counting the breaths, so there's even less chance of other thoughts entering into your mind. And then relax your mind, bring attention back to present. Little exercise. Did you have a question? Oh. How did you find? Those of you, anyone doing meditation for the first time? All of you have meditated before? Okay. I want to try to get a comment from someone. Anyone have any observation? Were you able to concentrate?
I run this thing back here.
Yeah.
And you really got to me today about trying to focus on my mind rather than the noise the PC was making next to me, thinking that that would disturb everybody in the room.
Uh-huh.
But that was, the first six breaths I did really well. the counting ones, mm-hmm. that's when it finally kicked in. And then 7 to the end, no problem. I was right on, I thought, yeah.
Oh, good, okay, good. I'm just curious, when you do this kind of breathing, and those of you who have done it maybe many times, many years, do you notice that your respiration becomes more regular and subtle as you meditate, as you do it? Yeah. So that's a very useful kind of technique to know, even in everyday world. There was a book that I think won the Nobel Prize in Literature back in the 50s, maybe, by... I can't remember. Maybe you'll remember the author. The Glass Bead Game. Der Glasspiel, Sperlenspiel. Has anyone ever read that book? I can't remember who wrote it. I was going to say Thomas Mann, but it wasn't Thomas Mann. Was it Hesse? Hesse wrote Das Glasspiel. He wrote many, many great books, Siddhartha and others about Buddhism. But the protagonist of this novel, at a certain point when he has to enter into a kind of mental competition, he would go to a room beforehand and do breathing meditation, sort of his secret, to calm his mind, to prevent other kinds of distracting thoughts, so to start with a clean slate. So if you have to go in to study, have to go into school, or if you have to go into work where you have to concentrate and do your best job, you're going into a job interview, or if you just have to pay attention to the recipe that you're trying to cook, do a little meditation beforehand. Sit down at your chair and just relax. Relax your body. Notice you can actually scan your body, although that's not emphasized so much in Buddhist, through the Buddhist system. Scan your body. Just watch the tension. Let it go. Start with a calm your body. Calming your mind is much more difficult calming your mind is much more difficult than calming your body. Although sometimes we've got tension in the body and it's hard to let go. They are related, of course. When your mind is upset, your body will be a little bit upset. If your body has some tension, that can affect your concentration. So start off calming your body, relaxing your body, and then reminding yourself, I find this useful, as I said before, I don't have to think about anything else right now. I don't have to think about the income tax or what I'm going to be doing later. I can attend to those tasks that might seem urgent during the meditation. I can attend to them more efficiently later when my mind is calm. So there's no need to worry, oh, I better think about this now. You know, there's always the idea that, oh, I've got this great idea that develop the perfect mouse trap. Have you ever heard that expression? You know, you have some brainstorm during the meditation session. I don't want to, pour water on your invention, but, let it go. Any other kind of insight that you might have when you're trying to calm the mind. The point of doing this kind of meditation is to have a level playing field to do a more constructive kind of meditation. This is not the end all of Buddhist meditation, simply calming the mind, right? If I wanted to work, I might take things off the tabletop so that I had a place to arrange my papers and what I'm working on, or just my other things. In the same way, you want to try to get rid of all of the thoughts that are running through your mind. Maybe the continuity of unhappiness. I mentioned that because and not that you necessarily are unhappy, but that's the case with many people in the world, that there is a constant sense of dissatisfaction, unhappiness, you know, something, I'm not good enough, I'm not loved, someone's not treating me right, I'm not getting my respect or whatever. So to let go of that, those kinds of trains of thought for some period of time, and then to reinvigorate the mind in a positive way. One of the Buddhist teachers who's kind of cognizant, savvy to Western terminology, who's going to be coming here in a couple of weeks, I think, Robert Thurman. Have you heard of Robert Thurman? He's used this expression, I don't think he's the first one, but I remember him using, reprogramming the mental hard drive. We're all a Durham triangle people, so you probably have some understanding of computers. if your computer is completely botched up, you might just not just reboot, but you might reformat your hard drive. Do you know what that means? Do you know what that means, this young lady? Erase, exactly, yeah. You know what I mean. Erase the whole thing and start fresh. So we've got all sorts of ideas in our mind that may be constantly playing in our mind what life is supposed to be about, what I'm supposed to be, what I'm supposed to be and what I'm not, you know, thinking that, you know, like we're living some kind of, what do you call it, facade, you know, some kind of false existence or something like that. All sorts of things might be playing in our mind. Let go of that. I think in Christianity, there's a famous expression of Christ, you have to be like a child. Who can think of the scriptural, some of you probably have studied Christianity in the past, who can think of the scriptural statement where Christ said something like, be unto children or something like that? Okay, yeah, I bet there's another illusion also, but that's probably one that that is quite relevant. So to enter into the kingdom of heaven, you have to have a very pure mind. So you have to have, like, get rid of all of your preconceptions. So this kind of meditation is a prelude to doing deeper kinds of meditation. The deeper kind of meditation is of various kinds. And as Geshe-la mentioned during the previous lecture, some of you have been coming for a long time and you know this already, but just to review, meditation basically means to familiarize your mind with a wholesome object. There are different ways of familiarizing. As he mentioned in his last lecture, you can recite a prayer. It is called sometimes called glance meditation. Like when we do the Guru Puja. We did Guru Puja since I've been here, right? Yeah, we did the other day. So one part of the Guru Puja is a glance meditation on the stages of the path. Those of you who are members who do that puja will know what I'm talking about. It's near the end of the puja when you go through a verse about the various meditations on various stages of path. That essentially is a type of meditation where you're familiarizing yourself with those stages, just glancing at them. You know, this and that. You know, you have to rely upon a spiritual teacher and recognize your good qualities, and then on the basis of that, recognize how this life is so fleeting, comes just once, is difficult to attain, and is so valuable. Not going into detail, that kind of meditation is called glance meditation. Okay, just familiarizing yourself with something that way. If you think about something again and again, it will become familiar. A way to engage the mind in another kind of meditation is when you analyze. It's not well understood in Western circles about Buddhist meditation, what we call analytical meditation. Have you heard that expression, analytical meditation? So not simply just glancing at something, but analyzing that statement about this life, that we have right now, wow, I'm going to die. How many times do we actually think about that? I probably think about it more than most of you. Maybe Jim, who drove me over here, and I we're starting to feel the aches and pains in our, you know, close to 70 or older. Some of you are much younger, so you don't think about that. I think sometimes when you read or you watch drama, or sometimes you see enactments of younger people making fun of older people. Oh, you old guy, you can't walk, or you know, we're all going to get old. Unless we die young, we're all going to get old, right? Anyone that doesn't think they're going to die? Of course, we know we're going to die, but we haven't brought that to mind in such a way that we have an understanding of it, a realization of it. That can be brought about through another kind of meditation called analytical meditation. Sometimes using the teachings that come from the scriptures, the explanation that the Buddha gave, or if you are someone who is trying to synthesize, say, Christianity or Judaism or Islam and Buddhism or some other, you know, I don't know, Wicca or something else, if you're trying to synthesize, use other teachings also, you know. Every moment, I'm getting closer to death. You can analyze like this, and you can think of various examples. I remember in India, one of the things we would seem very precious was our powdered milk for our tea, you know, because it's hard to have refrigerators everywhere. So you'd start out with a nice big one of these cans of powdered milk. You know the kinds that I'm talking about? I don't know, maybe we don't have here so much. And at first, you know, no problem. You put a big scoop in because you've got a lot. But day by day, you have to go down deeper, or your coffee supply, or your sugar, or whatever, you know. And you recognize that it's diminishing with every spoon, with every drop. If you have a container that's got a leak in it, just a little bit of water is leaking out or oil is leaking out of your oil bottle, you might think, oh, that's okay, it's just so small. But you come back a couple days later and you can see some discernible diminishing, right? And you can recognize, you can use these kind of examples in your analytical meditation. Like that, every moment, my life's expectancy, you know, when I will actually die is getting closer. I'm diminishing my lifespan with every second. And rather than using that in analytical meditation as a cause of, just despair or existential, what would you call it? Angst? To recognize the counterpart from the Buddhist perspective, I'm losing the opportunity to make use of this life in the way that it is most beneficial. I have a life that's so beneficial, not simply to experience flavors and friendship and love. Those are things that we often let's say the meat and potato kind of person, you know, they have their meat and potatoes and their flavor and their relaxation from the work that they have to do. We have that side of our psyche to experience the sensual pleasure of embrace or kind words from others that are our friends, are our family, loved ones, you know. I love you, mommy. I love you, daddy, you know. From our companions. But beyond that, all of that has to be left. What we can be using this life for is developing qualities now that make us a better person right now, and developing qualities that can benefit us in the future, future lives. So these are the kinds of aims of analytical meditation. There's another kind of meditation when you analyze within that clean slate. You do your breathing meditation first, or other kinds of meditation. You clean off the slate of the mind, and then you replace that emptiness with some object that you are analyzing or contemplating. Okay, it might be the subject of love. I think that's a very good topic of analytical meditation. Once you've come to a conclusion of your analysis, let's say in when you talk about love, how would you meditate on love? Do you have an idea? This young gentleman, what if I said, now we're going to meditate on love, what would you think? What would you do? Have you meditated before? What would you think to do if that's all the instruction was?
Sure. I guess I would think about briefly what love is for other people, others to have happiness. And then I might think about my standard course of a day and kind of places where that exists and what that looks like.
Good. So also what I would... From a Buddhist perspective, what one might do is to think the benefits of having a loving mind, how when we're loving, we are accepted by others, that others love us. You know, if we feel alien and lost in the world, if we have more of a loving demeanor, even though there'll be some people who will disrespect us and maybe even try to take advantage of us and so forth, that in general, life goes much more easily. My blood pressure goes down. I feel more happy. All many, many benefits that one might imagine. And then one tries to develop that thought, that state, through analyzing the benefits and what it means. The thought of love, what does love mean? It's not something having to do with possession, you know, that I love my child or I love my companion, but it's a state of mind that focuses on other living beings, whether they be animals or humans or even bugs, anything that has a mind, recognizing how they don't have all of the happiness that they could have, wishing them to be happy, like the prayer that we did at the beginning. Wouldn't it be wonderful if all living beings had happiness in the cause of happiness? Then to try to develop that state in the meditation on love, the conclusion of the meditation is not just thinking, oh, I meditated on love, you know, love is a good thing. You know, may everyone be happy. You know, like that, not really affecting your mind, but actually developing your mind stream into a state that's kind of glowing and thinking, wanting others to be happy, almost smiling from your mind, you know, radiating out. It's said that, in the scriptures, it's said that meditating on love for even one instant, you know, snap of a finger, is of so powerful in terms of its consequences for us. In Buddhism, we talk about karma. Have you heard of that word? Karma? That our actions have results. Karma means action. So even an instant of love has consequences far beyond other kinds of actions that we can do without that state of mind. You know, you can be generous. You give someone on the street who's in need of money, you give them some money, but with a little bit of disrespect and a little bit of impatience and irritation or something like that. That kind of action might be seen as meritorious to a certain degree, but even an instant of meditating on love actually developing within your mind stream that state, wanting others to be happy, you know, wishing them, you know, almost glowing like that, has much more positive consequence. So once you have developed that conclusion to your analytical meditation, you've meditated about love, its benefits, what it is, thought about it, and actually developed that state of mind, then to remain in that state without any other distraction, no longer analyzing, is a third kind of meditation that's called stabilizing meditation. Or something, maybe you've heard the word samadhi. Have you ever heard that word? Samadhi, single point of concentration, or sometimes we call tranquil abiding meditation, concentrating the mind. So there's glance meditation when you're familiarizing with something just by thinking about it again and again without going into detail. There's analytical meditation when you actually focus on one of those facets and analyze it in different ways. I'm going to, you know, the benefits of love, you know, and what love actually means. And then once you recognize what love actually means, trying to develop your mind into that state, that's a kind of analysis also. That's called analytical meditation. And then finally, once you've developed a conclusion like that, you've actually entered into that state, holding it single-pointedly. That's what's called stabilizing meditation. So that's the purpose of this breathing meditation at the beginning. That's not the end-all. Some people think they even do a three-month retreat in a group when all they do is do breathing meditation. But there's some benefit. But in the end, that they leave that meditation, they may not have changed their minds. They may not have changed their behavior, their inner operating system on their hard drive has not been altered. They've just sort of just is as though turning the computer off for a while, for 3 months. You know, that can be beneficial when we've got so many worries. When you've got so many problems, rather than worrying about them, even going to sleep for a while. If you can't control anything else, that's like turning off the computer. Even that can be beneficial. Or doing breathing meditation, so to forget about things. But in the end, you're going to have to think about those problems and solve them in a positive, what we'd like to think, spiritual way. From Buddhist perspective, or whether you're, like again, as I say, if you're amalgamating your Christianity or Judaism or Buddhism or other religions, Islam or whatever, with Buddhism, to try to use those spiritual teachings to reformat your hard drive. Okay. So let me ask you, do any of you have any questions about the Buddhist practice or Buddhism without feeling any embarrassment? Ask away. If there's something that you maybe have been hesitant to ask, now's a chance. Anyone? This young lady in the back with the white dress and the nice hair. Do you have a question? No? Okay. I just thought it. Yeah? Okay. You're just in a receptive mode, not a reactive mode, huh? Okay. So, following on to what we were just talking about, when we talk about the states of mind that are positive, like love and compassion, do you know the difference between love and compassion from a Buddhist perspective? Yeah.
Love is the desire that others are happy, and compassion is the desire that others are not.
Right. We can, in everyday language, if we don't talk about Buddhism, we might say, well, it means essentially the same thing, be loving, compassionate. It may not be very clear or if we're into words, we may look up in Webster's dictionary what the definition is, may not actually be exactly that in the dictionary, but from a Buddhist perspective, what Pat said is spot on from a Buddhist perspective. Love is a state of mind that in observing other beings, let's say other humans, wants them to be happy, wishes them to be happy. And that state of mind then, if you see someone, if you see a little child who's crying or another person who's in distress, if you have that state of mind, you will be empowered, or how to say, energized, to try to change their situation where they're unhappy, to bring about their happiness, you know, to give them something that they don't have, to offer them the last piece of cheesecake. I think of that often because I like Geshe-la. I think Geshe-la used the example of cheesecake often. I like cheesecake. I like pizza. You know, if there's one last piece of pizza, there might be, we'll be talking, but once in a while my eyes will be glancing down to the last piece that I might get. You might notice that with other people. Don't focus so much on other people, but you might notice that too when there's a, you know, who's going to get the last onion ring, you know, or whatever. So a loving state of mind would, if you see someone who is like that, just immediately offer to them, you know, wanting them to be happy. Compassion is a state of mind that is also observes living beings' situation and recognizes their discomfort and wants them to be free of suffering. The two states of mind, if you do have real love for living beings, you will have compassion for them. But they won't necessarily be present at the same time in your mind. They may alternate, love and compassion. They're slightly different. Compassion, say if you see the little child in the market that's lost their mommy, and they're sort of like they're upset, you may alternate. In one moment, you want to give them some, you know, affection. Nowadays, it's when I was a kid, it was so different. Nowadays, almost you can be arrested by trying to show some affection to a child in the market, isn't it? When I was in Wisconsin, there was a grandmother who'd lost her grandchild. She'd gone to the post office, and while she was inside, the kid was playing. And I was walking around with her around the neighborhood and trying to find the child. It turned out okay at the end. But one policeman drove up in a car and the siren and stopped and, you know, people said, "You're looking for this little child." You know, and it's sad that we've reached that point, but that's, one has to be cognizant of that, what is politically proper, what is correct socially and so forth. But you may alternate between wanting someone or your own child, if they're upset, wanting them to be happy and wanting to get rid of their suffering. There may be some things you do to alleviate their suffering and some things to bring them some happiness. You give them a lollipop or, you soothe them in some way. Compassion is considered to be one of the hallmarks of Buddhist practice. The Buddha, the Dalai Lama, who's a great example of a Buddhist practitioner, is considered to be very, very compassionate. The Dalai Lama is considered to be a kind of a physical manifestation of that state of mind, from having trained his or her mind in previous lifetimes. When I say that, because the Dalai Lama is not necessarily a man. Dalai Lama is a mind stream that may take different genders at different times, right? It's not, we're not, those of you who are men right now are not always men. in other lives we may be women. Those of you who are women now are not always women. There's some lifetimes you've been men. But this state of mind of compassion is something that by practicing now, familiarizing with, meditating on, so thinking about it, just thinking about the words, glance meditation, like the meditation we did, that can bring back remembering consciousness of other deeper meditation experience you have. Doing analytical meditation can leave a deeper imprint in your mind of these concepts. Like when you're on the beach, if you just gently just touch the sand with your hand, there may be just a little impression. But if you, and of course, if you're moving your hand around, it'll be kind of fuzzy, right? But if you leave your hand and you press it into the sand or into the mud or into the clay, it can leave a very clear, deep impression that can remain there for a longer time, right? That's one of the purposes of meditation, familiarizing. The more concentration you have, not being distracted by other thoughts, the more focused your meditation can be, the more concentrated it can be. That's why we do, at the beginning, a meditation to calm the mind. You know what lasers are, right? Anyone here doesn't know what a laser is? I remember when I was a kid, when I was in college, there was the provost of my college had won the Nobel Prize in physics for inventing the maser that came before. You know what maser? Microwave instead of light. Microwave amplification by stimulated emission of laser radiation. So a laser is something which is very concentrated. If you were to take a light bulb and laser of the same energy and place them next to and focus them on the wall, the light bulb might warm the wall a little bit because its energy is dispersed in many different directions, right? The laser concentrates all its energy in one spot. So it might not just heat the wall, it might bore right through the wall, right? Cut right through the wall. So like that, when our mind is not distracted and we've developed the facility of meditation, we can leave a very deep imprint in our mind of what we're meditating on. Let's say on love and compassion. So that's one of the purposes of doing this breathing meditation at the beginning. So let's finish up. We've got about a little over 10 minutes. Let's do a little analytical meditation. No, you have a question now. Good. You're going to? Good.
Hey, I was going to ask, when do you kind of do each type of meditation, or how much should you kind of do of each type of meditation in general?
Sometimes you may have a practice. You may have in your room or your house, you might have a little area where you do your meditation. Do some of you have like that? Some don't yet. It's advantageous if you can find a little corner where you can constantly do. You can set up maybe an image of the Buddha, or image of Christ and. In Islam, do people put image of Muhammad? They don't, do they? You would put maybe the syllables. Are there some syllables that are symbolic that can, on the mosque? Are there any kind of symbols? This lady was shaking her head about the Muhammad. Would you know? All symbols, okay. Different religions at different times have gone through periods when there have been non-formalistic. Islam, I think, for the most part, is non-formalistic in the sense of no images of the Godhead and so forth. There's some religions that have both. Like Buddhism has both images and non-image-related meditation. some that are very image related, like in Christianity, image of Christ on the cross and so forth like that. So it's not set in stone, but you, on your altar, you can put something that can remind you. And when you sit down to meditate, you can begin by doing a little calming meditation, just, you know, breathing meditation. Once you become familiar with it, even 7 breaths, your mind can be calm. That might seem remarkable, it might not seem remarkable. Then to do a glance meditation. So if you have a prayer book of not just these kind of prayers that we're doing, but also, let's say, a glance meditation on the stages of the path, if you know what I'm talking about. Some of you won't know necessarily what I'm talking about. To do a little glance meditation to remind yourself of the stages. Then to do an analytical meditation. And so the glance meditation might be like 4 minutes, 5 minutes. You know? Then to do an analytical meditation on one of those topics, like on the inevitability of my death, how everything is changing. My relationships are changing. There's nothing that is will remain within this world without changing. There's no need to be angry at the enemy because the enemy can become my friend, will eventually become my friend sometime, so forth and so on. That I myself am approaching death. Do an analytical meditation like this for even a little longer than the 5 minutes. So calming meditation for 3 or 4 minutes, a glance meditation for 5 minutes, and then analytical meditation for the longer period of time, whatever you have at your disposal. And then to, at the end of the analytical meditation, whatever conclusion you've come to, whatever, to be satisfied with whatever understanding you've come to, let's say about the inevitability of death, that might sound morbid to some of you. Does it sound morbid, meditating on death? To hold that single-pointedly in single-pointed concentration, with no longer needing the analysis, just holding the flavor of that. So calming, a little bit of glance meditation, always useful to sort of look at the whole path, where we are. I'm human. I have this incredible opportunity. It doesn't come all the time. It's changing. The very nature of life is suffering. There is a way to escape from this suffering, you know, to go through the stages of the path, and then to focus every day on one of those meditations, to do analytical meditation, and then as a conclusion of that analytical meditation, to focus on that single-pointedly. Then to dedicate your merits, get up and have your coffee. You might have had coffee before. Okay, good question. Okay, let's finish off with a short meditation. Again, see if you can count 7 respirations. Don't do your breathing quickly. Just watch your breathing, first of all, without counting. Just let your body relax. Let your mind relax. And count 7 respirations. If you lose count, if you forget that you're breathing in or out, go back to 1. then continue, you know, without moving, without changing. Just focus your mind in a different way. Think how wonderful it would be if everyone was happy, had the causes that would sustain that happiness. Why would they then analyze? Why would that be great? Well, there'd be no longer the discontent people on the streets that might want to rob or assault others, assault me, if people were basically happy. People had jobs. They had their health. They were respected by others. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Not only would they themselves be happy, but there would be this consequence that others around them would be benefited. I myself would benefit. I myself, because at the beginning of our spiritual practice, we're still very dominated by our own ego, to think I myself would be benefited if others were happy. There would be harmony in my family, in my neighborhood, in my nation, in the world. If people were happy, had the causes of spiritual happiness, there would not be so much tendency to cheat others. Usually why people cheat, deal dishonestly in business, take advantage of others, in government and so forth, is because they're basically discontent. There's something that they're lacking, they're trying to get. Not necessarily wishing that everyone was, had all of the illicit funds that they might like to have in government, but that their minds were happy and content. Wouldn't that be wonderful? If their minds were calm, like I'm trying to develop in my own mind. Dogs, cats, all of the little bugs that you might place your fingertip on and they try to escape. They all have mind. They want to be happy. They want to be free of suffering. Our children, the children that we see, adolescents, teenagers, young adults, middle age, older adults, our parents, our grandparents, wouldn't it be wonderful if their minds were happy? It'd be no harm. It's not as though that there are some people who don't deserve happiness. It would be wonderful if everyone had happiness and the cause of happiness. Thinking in that way, see if you can just, seeing the logic of that, the correctness of that, the beauty of that, hold that thought of love. Then recognize that during this period, this morning, we have created some good energy. Buddhists would say we've created some karmic imprints in our mind. that will definitely have consequences in the future, positive consequences, dedicate those karmic imprints in our mind due to these merits. May I become a better person. May I be able to continue to practice spiritually, become a better Christian, Muslim, Jew, Buddhist. As a result of this, may that improvement of my behavior, becoming more loving, compassionate, and wise, generous, may that have repercussions to all living beings that I encounter. May I become a source of happiness for my family, for strangers that I encounter, for even my enemies. May I, as a result of these merits, may we reconcile eventually, quickly. Due to these merits, may I quickly become fully developed, reach my highest potential for the welfare of all living beings. Even that kind of dedication is a meditation. Try to hold that single-pointedly. Thank you very much. So we're right on time, 10:05. Thanks so much for coming. If you are interested in studying a little bit about Buddhist psychology on, is it Friday evenings? I can't remember. What's the night that we have the Mind and Mental Factors class? Friday. If you have time, you're welcome to come. And hope to see you again here. Take care.